Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. We have a lot more people subscribing to our Patreon. Thank you very much. That's awesome. We are planning on a mini-sode coming up, the Slender Man stabbing. A lot of other podcasts have covered it, so we're just going to do it on our Patreon. So look for that. And please subscribe if you aren't already. I know that I will just go out and hit play on a lot of podcasts and never subscribe to them, but subscribing does help. So if you're on iTunes, hit that subscribe button, whatever you use on your Android phone. Thank you very much.
A special thank you to Marin from Australia. It was a very nice email, and messages like that, well, you know, they make our day. So thank you.
So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight's topic is a Canadian one.
Yay!
Well, it may not be yay after you learn what happened, but the Belcher Islands Massacre.
And this is the Belcher Islands that are located...
in Hudson Bay.
Hudson Bay, exactly. And what year was this?
1941. I know lately we've been covering a lot of murder cases, some of them involving possibly innocent people. This one really caught my eye because it's an older case. I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing, but if you've ever seen an old movie titled The Gods Must Be Crazy, where a man finds a Coke bottle and then crazy things happen afterward, this is kind of similar, except it involves Inuit finding a Bible.
Yeah, and then it turns into Jamestown.
We should start by saying that most people on this planet have a need to be spiritual or to have a religion, to have a god.
To have a belief system of some sort.
And in the Belcher Islands, this Bible that had been translated into the Inuit language, well, it was quite different from their normal belief system.
So what do they normally practice or believe in? I know they have shamans and medicine men, but what's their religion?
They believe that there are spirits in everything, even poop. The Inuit religion, they have gods for, you know, as we said, there are spirits in everything. Say, Cadlu would be noise, Quitu would be fire, and then Ignistok would be pisses. Now, I'm not pronouncing these correctly, probably, but there's some very interesting spirits that are described in their religion. Some of them are just downright demonic. And you can go down a rabbit hole reading about these creatures, and they're very strange indeed. But I would recommend, if you're interested in other religions, definitely check out this animism system that the Inuit believed in. It's known as animism. So there's animism and shamanism. And some of the gods that you hear about are pretty interesting.
So it sounds like a branch of Native American belief systems.
Very much about having to do with spirits. Mm-hmm. Everything has a spirit. The Belcher Islands, they are not very accessible, especially previous to the time that we'll be talking about. The Hudson Bay Company did a lot of surveys, and they attempted to go over there a lot, but they didn't find that, you know, setting up a post there would be worth it. Normally, you could set up a post and you could trade with the people that live there. You could trade them goods for furs, say fox furs or eider skins. They didn't really feel it was worth it. And ships moving into that area often had trouble and would wreck. So kind of dangerous. The region is very rocky. There's quite a bit of wind. Wind's pretty normal over there, I guess.
There's not a lot of trees and foliage to block the wind either, because a lot of this is just sheets of ice.
Yeah, there are sheets of ice, and the region can be fairly rocky.
What are the average temperatures in this area?
Well, in the winter, it's negative 23 or so Celsius. And then in the summer, it's about, on average, it's about 10 Celsius.
So it's always below freezing with a wind chill. Horrible, horrible conditions.
Well, and that's why they need to wear their parkas. And anyone that lives in a very cold region would wear caribou skins to protect them from the cold. But something happened around 1880 out in the Belcher Islands where ice just took over the feeding grounds of these caribou, and they changed their migration. So they don't have any caribou. What they would do instead is they would use eider duck skins, and it takes, I think, twice as many. It's actually a lot heavier of a parka, but they make do. They've just switched over to eiders from caribou. And the sea ice can take over quite a bit of the area, but this actually helps them to go from island to island, or to get to other trading posts, or to find other hunting grounds. So the ice actually allows them to travel better, because travel by boat is kind of dangerous anyway.
Yeah, you got all kinds of icebergs. You have the sea ice, which is just huge blocks of ice that weigh hundreds of pounds. So navigating through that is just, I don't know how they would do it. So what does this do for the animals and wildlife when the ice is taken over like this?
Well, they have a surprising amount of wildlife out there. But really what makes the biggest change is the Hudson Bay Company moves in, and in 1928 establishes a seasonal trading post. The Inuit people that live there, they start to discover, hey, instead of going hunting and fishing like they normally do, they can actually just trap animals and then trade the skins in for goods from the Hudson Bay Company. And so they go from a hunter-gatherer type people to trapping
for pelts. Over the years, with the conditions getting more and more harsh, it seems that there's less and less animals for them to trap, and it's sort of a famine.
Well, as we said, it's the cases we'll be covering it. It happened in 1941, and around that time, hunting conditions got worse. So they were able to hunt less, or at least they were bringing in less prey. And not only that, but because of World War II, there really wasn't any movement from the people they would trade with. So all of the planes were taken over by the Royal Canadian Air Force, and that really cut down on goods being dropped off. the Inuit people that lived in the area were starting to experience real hardship. And the Canadian government said that they were the most destitute people they had ever come across.
They'd shifted their lifestyle from hunter-gatherers to trappers because of the trading post. But because of the war and because of the lack of animals, they were pretty much left out in the cold.
Yeah, and it said that only the best hunters would be able to bring in what the people needed. And so your average hunter just wasn't doing that well anymore. There were some very good hunters at the time in 1941. One of them was Peter Sala. But the Hudson Bay Company in 1915 had a prospector in their employment named Robert Flaherty. And he went to the Belcher Islands with a motion picture camera. The really sad thing was, apparently he had shot a lot of footage of the people and of the life out there. He was smoking a cigarette and he caught the film on fire. It went up in smoke, literally. So he had to reshoot. And he would make a film titled Nanook of the North. This is very much like a blend between a documentary and a movie. Because the way the Inuit people are depicted in the film weren't exactly accurate. You know, he asked them to act a certain way, I do believe. Nanook means polar bear. So he used this name instead of the real name of the person because it was too difficult to pronounce for the average person. Despite the film being dishonest about the authenticity of this main character, who actually knew a lot about white people, when in the film he seemed like it was a new discovery and he had no idea about white people at all, it still became very popular and revealed this world that most people had no idea existed. So I think it's much like zoos are. You know, you can look at a zoo and you can come up with a lot of negatives about the zoo. But on the other hand, you are exposing people to animals and hopefully getting them to appreciate them more. It's kind of like a mixed bag.
And this film probably drove home that these people were very isolated with very little contact with the rest of the world, since the rest of the world didn't know about them. But as we said before, they are trading with the Hudson Bay Trading Company. They do have different businesses and ties to the real world.
We mentioned Peter Sala before, and another man who is around at the time in this camp is Charles Oirac.
Sorry if we're mispronouncing his last name. It's hard to say.
He's a short, frail 27-year-old Inuk who, after a meteor shower, declares himself Jesus Christ.
Well, hold on. Why does he do that?
There's a man who's an elder in the camp, and we'll attempt to say his name is Kidawek. And he was 47 years old, possibly considered a shaman. He was reading the Bible, and he was telling others about Jesus. Charles, or Charlie, really picked up on this. For some reason, they were kind of associating the meteor shower with this new religion.
It was a sign from the heavens.
Right. We don't really know the true motivation here of Charlie, but it seems as though he wanted to move up in status. He wasn't content with being not a great hunter and probably not real popular either. By becoming Jesus Christ, I suppose he was hoping that that would move him up status-wise and he would become more popular. That would be my guess anyway. Sounds innocent enough. This other man, Kitawik, he's the one that's considered to be the one that people would normally go to. And Charles is now Charlie is saying, hey, I'm Jesus.
I'm the guy. Come to me.
Peter Sala, he's a very tall man, and he was considered to be the best hunter in the Belcher Islands. Not long after, I mean, we're talking days, maybe 2 days after Charlie declares himself to be Jesus. And the people, because of Charlie, I do believe, start referring to Peter as God. And Peter doesn't exactly come out and say, guys, I'm just Peter.
No, he accepts it, but he plays along with Charlie or Jesus.
Now, this will have a big effect because Kitawik's been reading the Bible. The Bible that he has been translated into the Inuit language. But he's really focusing on the end of the world. And so there's some prophecy going on. And this starts to spread. And with Jesus now around, now I guess you could say things are escalating. Both God and Jesus here, talking about Charlie and Peter, kill quite a number of sled dogs. They told people that the end was coming and miraculous things were going to happen. So they didn't need all these sled dogs anymore. As we said at the time, they were going through some real hardship. The hunting was not as good. The value of the goods they would trade for other goods, you know, that had gone down in value. One of the things that happened was that fox furs between the 1920s and 1940s had dropped in value from about, you know, I'd say to about a quarter of its value. So you can see how things were getting hard for them. So people were getting hungry and they were kind of losing some hope. Things weren't looking so good. So when they're hearing that the end is coming and that there's going to be this rescue of sorts, and all these miracles would happen, you know, amazing things, they started to get a little excited. And it wasn't long before, I'd say about 35 or just over that of the 200 people in the camp were following him, were saying, you're Jesus.
They had to have been destitute. They had no hope. They weren't getting anywhere. So the New Testament, they read some passages out of Exodus. And now we have two men who say they are the most important deities in the world.
And some of these miracles were, you know, they said, well, if we don't have the sled dogs, how are we going to get around? And they said, don't worry. When the end comes, then all of you will be able to fly.
And they say everything will be provided for you. So we don't need material possessions. We don't need anything.
Yeah, it'll be the end of hunger.
Saying you can fly to me sounds like crazy promises made to get people to just buy into this, to just carry on with their idea. You know, obviously 35 of them are buying into this, but we still have over 150 that are not.
The sled dogs were just the beginning, though. The divinity of the two men was not to be questioned. The first person to come out and say, you're not Jesus, you're not God, was on January 26th, a 13-year-old girl, Sarah Apokuk. She told Peter, you're just Peter Sala on the outside and Peter Sala on the inside. But he said, no, I'm God. Charlie, Jesus, said that this girl was Satan. And what he did was he grabbed a Primus stove. It's like a little handheld stove, and you can light it, and then you'll have a flame coming out the top of it.
Yeah, just to heat a can of something.
Yeah, you could heat a can up with it. And he put it right up to her face.
So when they held that up to her face, they were verifying that she was evil, that she was Satan. And somehow the light of this little, you know, oven, this little stove, is going to tell them everything they need to know. They are now interpreting that this flame will tell them if somebody is evil or not.
And then her half-brother, who is the son of Robert Flaherty, the man we told you about who had visited in 1915 and 1916, would really get angry with her. And he hit her a number of times with a piece of driftwood. After she's struck with a piece of driftwood, she's then taken out and she is beaten to death with the barrel of a rifle by another girl who isn't much older than her, named Akinik. And she then declares that she has killed Satan. And then they held a celebration because Satan was dead.
She complained that her hands were cold after beating the other girl to death with the barrel of a rifle because metal's pretty cold in this temperature. So that was her reaction to this murder. Satan is now dead and they can carry on.
Kitawik, he's an elder and a lot of people respected him. After what happened with Sarah, he came out and said, No, these two men, Jesus and God. No, they're not Jesus and God. They're just men. They're just Peter and Charles. On January 27th, Peter and another man named Adlaitok would attack Kitawik. Peter would harpoon him twice, once to the body, I believe, and then once in the face.
So Peter's now embraced his role and will not be challenged.
Adlaitok would take a weapon and shoot him twice. After Kitawik was dead, Peter declared, "I have killed Satan."
So anyone that's speaking up and questioning these men, they're being labeled as Satan and murdered.
Adlaitok had gotten ammunition. He needed bullets from Jesus to stop Satan. And of course, celebration. It was this death of the elder, the Inuit elder, that, like you said, really drove home that the others in the camp needed to comply with Jesus and God. Because if you spoke out against them, if you weren't with them, you were against them.
Well, Satan's the great deceiver, and Satan's the only power that will challenge God. So anybody that does that is Satan. Anyone that challenges them is Satan in their mind.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
This is February of 1941. Charles and Peter move everyone to Tukaruk Island, and they move to a camp that's run by Karuk. I guess Karuk doesn't have any problem with Peter, aka God, taking over, because Peter's running everything, right?
Yeah, it's sort of an alpha male deal. I think he just isn't willing to challenge, and maybe he knows what they're capable of, so he's not going to put up a fight.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's quite it. I mean, I almost want to say that when these two men come in and declare themselves as Jesus and God, that he just accepts it. Because there's a man named Ikpok. He's 26 years old, and he was Kitawik's son. And we don't know for sure whether he knew his father had been murdered or not. That's up in the air, but he defied them as soon as he came across them. He said that they weren't Jesus or God. And on February 9th, Karuk said he did believe, and he shot Ikpok twice. And he declared Satan is dead. So now Satan has died 3 times.
So the leader of the other tribe, son, questioned.
The shaman, the Inuit elder, Kitawik, from the original camp, his son, Ikpok, was in the new camp. And so when Jesus and God go there, he's the first one to come out and say, no, you guys are not Jesus and God. I know who you are. You're Peter Sala. And they weren't having it. Karak is the one that kills him.
So Karak is the leader of the other tribe, though.
Well, I think he was up until Peter shows up. So now we have three deaths. And at this point, a man who is an employee of the Hudson Bay Company who's around contacts his company and says, hey, we've had three murders out here. We need to get the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
But this is all by telegram. So it takes time to send, takes time to reply. This is not a speedy process.
In March of 1941, Peter Sala and a man named Ernest Riddell, who is a post manager for the Hudson Bay Company, leave for Great Whale. While they're traveling, Peter Sala seems to change his tune. I mean, up to this point, he stood strong. He was against Satan. He was God. But now while he's traveling with Riddell, he tells him a number of times that he's a bad man. And by that, he's saying, I'm a bad man.
Not I'm God. He's saying I'm a man and I've done something wrong.
Yeah. They're gone for some weeks. And in the meantime, Jesus or Charlie is winning over Peter's sister, Mina. She's married to a man named Moses, but, you know, Moses can't compete with Jesus.
Yeah.
She started going around and telling everyone that Jesus was going to return soon. Now, you might be wondering, some of you, why, if she's now dating this Jesus, why she would be saying that Jesus is coming soon. But it has a lot to do with he has the spirit of Jesus in his thoughts, I guess is the best way I can describe it. So he's basically speaking for Jesus, but Jesus will actually return riding a kayak from the sky.
Right. So I get it. The Holy Spirit is in Charlie. So he's behaving or acting as a proxy for Jesus. And Peter's the God. And then the real God, real Jesus, is going to return.
It's something very similar to that. When anybody has written about this, it's said that he's telling people that he has both Jesus and the Holy Spirit in him.
And because of their other beliefs, you're kind of seeing a mingling of the two. And you're seeing a very basic understanding of Christianity being forced onto their belief system. So he's going to return in a kayak. That sort of makes sense why they would think that way. Because anyone else who thinks of the return of Jesus is just a light in the sky, or there's all kinds of different beliefs out there. So I'm not going to generalize too much.
Right. And the other way that they meld the two is he's saying that the spirit of Jesus, the spirit of the Holy Spirit are in him. And so people can kind of relate to that because they believe there are spirits in everything. It's just he has special spirits.
Yeah.
Mina really starts taking this far because she's telling people that Jesus is coming soon. On March 29th, she takes about 12 people who are mostly women and children and starts pushing them towards the ice. That would be dangerous. I mean, because it's so cold and she's getting to go out there. Now they're starting to resist. They're starting to say, I don't want to go out there.
Yeah. I want to stay in my igloo where it's warm. I don't want to be outside. It was
in their homes.
Yeah. They want to stay in their shelters and not come out into the elements.
But she has a dog whip and apparently these are kind of nasty. It sounds like a pistol shot when you crack it, and that some of the sled dogs they use can sometimes be missing an eye or have like a chip off the ear because these dog whips will actually do damage if they make contact. And she's whipping this and cracking this at people, urging them to go forward. And while she's doing that, she's telling them, you know, Jesus is coming. And she said, you won't need your material things. You need to remove your clothes. You won't need them anymore. Jesus is coming. The end is coming. A couple of the adults, they finally had enough. They're like, nope, we're not doing this. There are kids out here. And they start to move kids back off of the ice onto the shoreline. and she's yelling still, trying to get them to stay out there.
Cracking this whip at them.
And the two people who are trying to help, one of them is Peter's wife. Her name is also Mina. She starts moving some children away from the ice. And then Mina's husband, who, you know, the crazy Mina, her husband Moses is out there trying to help and get kids away. Sadly, half of them die. And I think this is very significant because we've already had three deaths, but now we have six dead, and they're dead from exposure. One was Peter's mother, who was Maria Nukarok. She was 55. Then Peter's son, Alec, who was 8. Johnny, 7, who was his adopted son. And then a woman named Kamudlak Sarah. She was 32. And her sons, Jonasi, 6, and Moses, who was 13. So God's family, basically.
All of his children.
He lost two sons. He lost his mother. He lost his nephews. He lost his sister. It's pretty bad. And he put together that he had gone on this journey with Ernest Riddell. And while he's gone, he's saying, I'm a bad man. And now, while he's gone, his family is being killed by his sister.
And his sister, I don't know how she's getting away with this, especially when God's wife is God's wife. I would just assume she would put her in check, but she's obviously a believer and she's taking this as far as she can. I'm assuming it's because she wants to up her status in the tribe.
I don't think she cared at all for anything that Peter's wife had to say. I think, again, we're talking about spirits inhabiting bodies, and she didn't have any divine spirit in her, so what she said didn't matter. And I also think that she saw Jesus as the real leader. That's what I think.
Not Peter, God.
No, right. She was interested in Charlie, in Jesus. Now, on April 2nd of 1941 is when Ernest Riddell, and Peter Sala return from hunting. And they come back with an Anglican missionary named the Reverend Nielsen, Reverend George Nielsen. Ernie finds out about the six deaths, and he sends a telegram to the RCMP, and he says, there have been further murders, come immediately. He even goes out and prepares a runway of sorts using coal sacks, and he's waiting nervously for a plane.
Because he knows if he's caught doing this, he will be killed.
Well, he's worried he might be. And he does have some protection. He has a .22 rifle, and he carries it with him wherever he goes. I don't think he really understood at the time that there just weren't planes sitting around waiting to take mounted police out there. But he's hopeful.
Yeah, all the planes are being used for the war effort, so they had no way of getting out there. Plus, it's such a remote area, you have to access it by plane.
But I think the RCMP understands the gravity of the situation. And with 9 deaths now, they really feel like they need to do something. And there were no regular patrols out there. There was no need to. They left those people to their own devices. They're their own people. The RCMP went on a mission to find a way to get out there to the Belcher Islands. And they ended up finding a plane that was in disrepair, and they had it repaired.
They had to go scavenge parts from other planes and piecemeal this thing together. I don't think I would want to fly that across icy oceans to an island, but they made it work.
I don't know. Maybe they have some good mechanics out there. Yeah. On April 15th, the Mounties announced that they have apprehended 7 people in connection with the 9 murders.
They make it out to the island, and as they approach the camp, they start questioning the people. And they're very open about it, eerily open about it. They do not deny anything. They explain matter-of-factly, well, this is what happened and this is why we killed these people. The investigators, or the mounted police, are able to determine who's responsible for this very quickly because they can just ask anybody and they tell them. There's no hiding or concealing anything. And so they are able to arrest the appropriate people.
On April 15th, the Mounties announced that they have apprehended 7 people in connection with the 9 murders. Peter Sala, Adlai Talk, Charlie Oryk, Alec Apotok, Akinik, Karak, and Mina. So there are 5 men and 2 women. Now, it takes till August 19th, but the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they put up a white tent. A trial will begin. The people involved here are Judge Plaxton, Judge Charles P. Plaxton. And the jury is pretty interesting because it consisted of 6 people, 2 mining engineers, Jack Ruby and Emmy Holtzman, 2 reporters who were there to cover what was going on, James McCook from the Toronto Star and William McKimmon from the Canadian Press, a ship's engineer named Ed Cadney, and a fur trader who worked for the HBC, Ernie Riddell.
So much for a trial by your peers here, though. They didn't really have anyone that was part of the tribe on the jury.
Well, okay, so there's 2 ways to look at this. You can look at it as they didn't respect the Inuit enough to let them judge their own people, their peers. Or they felt like they would be working from the ground up with them, and that would be too much work, and they needed to make this happen quickly because they don't have a lot of time. Getting people there, I mean, with the war going on, making this trial happen is difficult enough.
With a language barrier, they probably have no concept of our legal system or the Canadian legal system. So trying to explain all of that to them, but still I'm a little perturbed that they don't have any of them on there.
Okay. So you could probably say, well, if they wanted to be fair, they could have found some people who had enough grasp of the English language that they could have used them, but it's still difficult to know whether they would have understood exactly what was happening. And I'll give you an example. When the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the judge and the prosecutor and everybody was coming in, the Inuit people were so happy to see them. And they didn't mind that some of their people were getting arrested or people were having a trial because they didn't quite understand what was happening. As Justin said, when they were being asked, okay, some people died. Oh yeah, it was so-and-so. They had no problem saying who it was. The gravity of the situation wasn't quite there in the way that you would imagine it would be. The trial would take place over a couple of days, and 6 of the 7 would be tried on the first day, which would be August 19th of 1941. Before they could really start the trial, one thing they needed to clarify and settle was Mina. They didn't know if she was sane or not because she acted so crazy. When she was driving those people onto the ice, she was using a dog whip and she was telling them to disrobe. And then from everyone they talked to, she was acting crazy. Even her husband was saying she was so normal. And then after Jesus came, then she started acting crazy.
It was a very short time period between this man declares he's Jesus and the first murder.
She's evaluated by a coroner. He says that he thinks she's sane.
Okay, so a coroner says she's sane when she's driven people out of their homes and onto the ice and kept them out there until they froze to death.
In regards to Mina being considered sane, she was taken to Toronto. And the psychiatrist there said she appeared to be normal. So they said she was fine to go back and stay on trial. Another note that's, I think, is really interesting here, when they're going to conduct this trial over the 2 days in August, the 19th and the 20th, and both the judge and the prosecutor is Richard A. Olmsted. And both of them say some things which today people might be taken aback by, like, whoa, don't say that.
A little racist.
It's very strange. They talk about how basically these are primitive people and that they're not as good as the white man. You know, that's basically what they're getting at because they're so primitive. They don't have modern understanding. They don't have the same justice system. They're not an advanced society. And even the prosecutor said that he doesn't seem to like applying the Canadian law to these primitive people.
He says, and they're using this argument in their favor, in their defense, saying they don't have a grasp, so they don't know that they're doing wrong with this misinterpretation of the Bible. And the prosecutor even says that he thinks it's a mistake because hanging these people is not going to deter them from doing anything. They're not going to understand the punishment or the justice that they would be extracting from them.
At the trial, they decide that she's not guilty for reason of insanity. Now, that's not quite right because that wasn't a real judgment at the time. What they were really saying is that it was temporary insanity. Now, Akinik, very similar, they said she's not guilty due to violent religious hallucinations. So in other words, she didn't know she was doing wrong because she was hallucinating, probably because of the misinterpretations. She was filled with these ideas that were wrong, but she didn't know it at the time.
I would call it more of a delusion than a hallucination, but yeah.
A number of the men were found guilty of manslaughter because they had mistakenly believed they had killed Satan. And this is something that's well documented from the trial, is that they say that there was an earlier case, I think from the 20s or so, where a man had killed another man because he thought he was a Wendigo. And so they can only give him manslaughter because he thought he was killing something that needed to be killed and only later realized he had made a mistake. And so they were applying the same reasoning to some of these men here because they were saying, oh, they made a mistake. If they had actually killed Satan, they'd be okay. But because it didn't turn out to be Satan, they had made a mistake. And so it wasn't first or second degree murder. There wasn't malice involved here in the same way that it would be if they had just killed another person out of jealousy or to steal their food.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
The transcripts from the trial are pretty straightforward. They say, did you kill this man? And they'll say, who? And they'll be like, did you kill him? And they'll say, yes. And they're like, did you have a problem with him? They'll say, no. And they're like, well, why did you shoot him? They'll say, Charlie said he was Satan. And that's it.
For instance, both Alec Apocock and Akinik stated that they thought Sarah was Satan at that time, but now they don't believe she was. They made a mistake. And Quarock, Adlai Tok, and Orok were tried together. Quarock said he didn't believe that Ikpok was Satan anymore. He said that he had had a conversation with the Reverend Nielsen later on, and that the Reverend Nielsen had enlightened him, was able to show him why that person was not Satan. And so he now realized that he had made a mistake. Now, Quarock, his sentence was suspended or remitted because the judge felt with the way things were going, and he had a feeling that they were going to be putting some of these people away, that it wasn't fair to take the best hunters away from the Inuit people. And so he said that Quarock, his sentence could be remitted because he could be a hunter and provide for his people.
Because he felt like he'd be killing the entire tribe if he removed this man from the tribe.
Yeah, they needed his hunting skills now more than ever.
The other mitigating factors of where they lived, the judge actually says life in this desolate region exposed to the cruelest conditions and even on the verge of extermination is not conducive to excessive gentleness. So it's the environment is a mitigating factor for his considerations of punishment.
Yeah. And speaking of that, not only was the environment a mitigating factor, but the people themselves. I mean, knowing what their history was and how this was all new to them, they didn't have the same amount of guilt that, say, a person in Toronto would have for murdering a neighbor. They had a completely different life. The conditions under which they were trying to live and this new religion together, it's almost like they were saying, these are mitigating factors. You can't, if they weren't combining in this perfect storm, these murders never would have happened. Adlai Tauk, he received 1 year in prison and hard labor. Orak, Charlie, the man who said he was Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit, he said that he was no longer Jesus. If you look over the trial here, everybody was coming out and saying, yeah, that was not me back there. They were totally disowning everything that they had believed. He also, you know, he admitted that he had given ammunition to Adlai Tauk to kill Kitawak. But yeah, he said that Kitawak was no longer Satan. He didn't believe that Kitawak had been Satan anymore. He basically said that he had made a mistake, you know, just like everyone else did. Orak's sentence was 2 years in prison with hard labor. Peter Sala, he went on trial the next day on August 20th, 1941. You know, we talked about it. He was the man in Belcher Islands, and he became God. If you look at what happened, especially after he left in March, and then, you know, when he came back in April, he found out that many of his family had been murdered. He felt incredible remorse. He said, as someone who everyone looked up to, he felt like he was the one who should have stopped all this. But I think it's the power, the feeling of power. I mean, he was already a powerful man before he was given that status of God. And then, you know, he was wearing it like a brand new suit. He felt good in it. And people were looking up to him even more than ever. He now, at that time, realized that this was a huge mistake. And it cost him a lot. It cost him many of his family members. And it would get him 2 years in prison with hard labor. Let's say this, you know, no one served more than about a year in prison, but this had a tremendous effect on them. I mean, Peter Sala, one of his sons said that life changed drastically after his dad was sent off to prison because they kind of lost hope and they weren't really accepted anymore. The damage was done and they were seen as people who had contributed to the damage. Many of his children started turning to drugs and alcohol. He had done an interview in the 1960s where he talked about this. And Peter Sala himself, he and his sister, they couldn't go back to the Belcher Islands. So they would kind of wander nomadically from camp to camp. And it wasn't until 1983 that he was allowed to go back. And he went back and stayed with his family. And I'd like to hope he had learned a lot and that when he went back, he was able to help repair some of that damage. But I don't have that information. I can only hope that that's what happened, that he was able to really help boost up his family after all the damage that he had caused. In this case, we're talking about basically two religions, and you have one that's animism. There are spirits and everything, and they have all these interesting stories about different spirits. And then you have Christianity, which, again, it's very much like that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy. You have a man who's considered primitive by first world country standards, and he comes across this Coke bottle and realizes that he has power with it. You know, he can hurt people with this Coke bottle.
But he can use it for good and bad. They use it as a tool. It helps them with their skinning. It can grant resentment and jealousy and envy, and it just causes all kinds of mayhem for his tribe. And it's similar to what we see here with the introduction of the New Testament and them trying to interpret this, trying to follow this, and turning on each other pretty quickly.
Again, we don't know the true motivations of these people when the murders are being committed. It seems as though some people believe that Mina just went crazy. And, you know, these people were desperate at the time. There's no way to know for sure. But I could almost see that. I could almost see that she just went crazy and really wanted to believe that Jesus was returning, that everything was going to be okay, and that the hard times were about over.
She seemed like a believer, a fanatic, whereas I don't know if Jesus or God believed what they were doing in the slightest. I think that was a power grab, and everybody else was falling in line.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When Charlie and Peter were tried, they were just themselves. But Mina, when she was at the trial, she was strapped to a gurney, and they said that she would scream out. And I know one author thinks that possibly she was being bitten by mosquitoes or something. But yeah, when you're strapped down, you can't move. You're at the mercy of whatever's on you.
She's probably never seen a gurney before. She's probably never been restrained before. I know when the airplanes landed, when they finally responded, a lot of the people in the group were not used to seeing a flying machine. So,
right. They thought it was a big bird.
Yeah. For some of them, this is new stuff. My initial reaction to that was, well, if they saw an airplane land, then they would obviously know that this guy isn't Jesus and this guy isn't God. But really, can they come up with that interpretation? I mean, they're going with what this man's saying, and they're taking him for his integrity. They're taking him for, they know him and they trust him. A plane landing isn't going to shake their belief.
I think the analysis is that these low sentences were just that they weren't punished as if they were real Canadian people. I mean, and that's what was highlighted at the beginning of the trial with the comments from the judge and the prosecutor, basically saying that we understand that we're dealing with people who don't understand our laws and don't live the way we live. When you have even the prosecution coming out with that, you kind of got the sense that that's where it was going to go. That's where we say, you know, how can you really judge someone without walking a mile in their shoes? Well, I don't think there's any way for any of us in a first world country to walk in the shoes of these Inuit people, especially back then. It's just so alien to what we know.
I think what they did was extremely horrible. And I think that the mitigating factors are what they are, but if they're not willing to take a warrior, a hunter out of this tribe because they know that it's going to be detrimental to the rest of the tribe, I wonder when you apply that to other systems, other trials, when you're removing a father or a mother out of a home, what are we doing with the rest of the family? You're removing a breadwinner out, and now everybody else has to pick up the slack. So at least when it comes to murder and the more egregious crimes such as that, yes, let's remove these people from society if they're a danger. But when it comes to far less crimes, whether they be property crimes, whether they be fines that you accumulate for parking in the wrong place, I don't think you should go to jail and you should remove somebody from a home for that. And I guess that's the only good thing I can see coming out of this, is I feel like they really did weigh out the ramifications of their decision and their punishment.
Right. And like that's what I said, is you can look over their comments and find them to be pretty condescending. But on the other hand, it seemed like they tried to be very fair.
They're giving them the benefit of the doubt by being condescending to them. What do you do with that?
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, it's very much a case of they just didn't have a very good teacher. And maybe Kitawak would have been a good teacher, but this gets to the heart of Charlie's motivations. Maybe he was just in it for the power. It seems like that's probably the case, and that the death of Kitawak, it was the death of his rival. That this was a guy who was talking about what the Bible had said, and yet Charlie, he wanted to be the one to dispense the information. And having this other guy saying, you're not doing it right, you're not saying it right, that's not going to fly. not if he has anything to say about it.
Is this story a popular one? Is this something that's in Canadian folklore or anything like that?
Well, I'm sure Canadian listeners have heard about it, but I don't know how well known this case is outside of Canada. Mm-hmm. I would venture to say it's not that popular, although there's a book out there. The book is titled At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic. Now, I must warn you, this book has decent information on the Belcher Islands massacre. It doesn't go into a lot of deep detail, but what the book is good for is it gives you a very good idea of what that place is like. The author also, but the author's name is Lawrence Millman. He tends to go on these long rants, or he also makes little snide comments here and there about smartphones and tablets and how they're making us dumb and making us really not worthwhile having on the planet. So I'm just saying, like, it has good information in it. And I think this is definitely a man who, he truly lives. He gets out there and really experiences the places that he visits. I really got the sense that he knows how to do that. But, you know, a lot of people were annoyed at his writing style because he keeps going back to the smartphones making us dumb and how people don't really communicate anymore. They just tap messages to each other. So if you can get past that, it has some pretty good information if you want to know more about this case. And I know that we've had some people writing in and saying, oh, when are you going to cover this cult or that cult? And I thought, what's interesting is we have this case, the Belcher Islands Massacre, which is very much like a cult case.
Yeah, it's not quite a cult. And I was trying to look up the definition of a cult and how do you define a cult and a religion. And the only thing I could really come up with is when the leader dies or is removed and the religion or group followers fizzle out, then it becomes more of a cult. But I don't like that definition because I think there are active cults where the leader is still very much alive and running the show. And I want to define them as a cult and not a religion. Between the two, it's hard to define which is which. But this is a group of people following a belief system that goes very much awry.
See, I always thought a cult was just a group of people who are following a person who is giving them the information and they're believing that person, even though that person has their own belief system. Yeah. And that's what I see here is they had this Bible that Charlie was reading, but I mean, he didn't really understand it that well. And they obviously were murdering people just because they didn't believe in them. And they did it at the command of these leaders, these people who had divine spirits in them. And sure enough, as soon as the mounted police show up and, you know, these people are arrested, it seemed like it all fizzled out.
I think you make a good point there, Aaron, where if the leader or the person or one person declares that they have, I don't know, magical or have some sort of enlightenment or empowerment that's not of this world, thus claiming their God, claiming their Jesus. And there's a lot of people that have done that over the time. I can mention Charles Manson or David Koresh off the top of my head. These people would say that they had something special about them that other people should follow. Whereas a lot of priests or preachers, yeah, they can just be a conduit to spread a word and not tell people to follow them directly, but follow the religion. Whereas a cult, I feel the people are leveraging the religion so people will follow them personally.
Right. And you have Charlie saying he's Jesus and Peter saying he's God. And if you recall, Mina, Peter's sister, was yelling at all these people to go out onto the ice, and she was whipping at them, and she was doing it for Jesus, the person she loved now. She gave herself to Jesus, and now she's willing to kill people because this is what they had in their minds, is this is how they were to greet the return of Jesus. Jesus was going to come down from the sky in a kayak. Yeah. It sounds crazy, and maybe she was.
And I've heard other people say that a cult is when something malicious or bad happens, but that's not always the case either. There are lots of groups that people would define as a cult
that don't murder people. They don't do these things because there's always some issue with any religion that people can nitpick and point out. But
right. They say it's not really clear, but looking up the definition, it does seem to say a social group with socially deviant or novel beliefs and practices. And I think that's what we're seeing with this. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.